Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In the Atlantic this month, the story, Fear of a Black President. As a candidate, Barack Obama said we needed to reckon with race and with America's original sin, slavery. But as our first Black president, he has avoided mention of race almost entirely. In having to be twice as good and half as Black, Obama reveals the false promise and doubled standard of integration. The author of the very interesting piece is our guest this hour. Ta-Nehisi Coates is our guest, senior editor for The Atlantic. Our phone number as we move along, I think we'll have a lot of response to this conversation, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Ta-Nehisi Coates, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, you covered a lot of territory in this piece, didn't you, sir? You had a big assignment here.
Well, I'm impressed by anyone who actually finished the article. So
I did. I found it fascinating. Well, let's start with Trayvon Martin. You say early in the piece that you call him, and I want you to define this more, you call him a conservative revolutionary. Nowhere is his conservative character revealed more in the very sphere that he holds singular gravity, and that's the issue of race. When he said, when this whole thing happened with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, when he said, when he thinks about his own kids, it's important that we pull together and figure out how this happened. But my main message, he said, and it was striking, I think, because he didn't talk very much about issues of race. If I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. What did that statement mean in its entirety?
Well, there's two parts. First, I think when I say that the president is a conservative revolutionary, I think it's really important to understand I mean small c. I mean not literally.
Right, right.
You know, in terms of the conservative movement. But his temperament is one of a conservative temperament. When you look at the statement, what was so, I think, how shall we say, polarizing. You know, I want to say something more than polarizing. We can say what was so polarizing was, typically, African Americans have aired grievance through protest. They generally appeal to the moral character of America. You know, you think of the marches, Martin Luther King, the Civil Rights Movement, saying this country should live up to the documents, to its chartering documents, to Declaration of the Independence, to the Constitution. It's an appeal. You know, it still leaves the country in charge to decide whether it's going to listen to that appeal or not. When Barack Obama spoke on Trayvon Martin, he wasn't appealing to anything. He was stating what he was going to do, and that is use the four powers of the state to find out what exactly had happened. That is a very significant break with which you've traditionally seen in African American history. Never has an African American had the ability to use power at a federal level on anything that had anything to do with race. And I think it really alarmed a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm. You talk about it then passed out of the national mourning phase and lapsed into something darker and more familiar, racialized political fodder.
Yeah,
what happened?
Exactly. Well, then there was this backlash. You know, before Barack Obama made his statement, there was a kind of... Well, it was outrage on the left, definitely, and among the right, there was this sort of feeling. If the feeling wasn't muted, you know, it was definitely that of, you know, that there had been that a tragedy had taken place. There wasn't, you know, a large effort to defend George Zimmerman. When Barack Obama spoke, the onslaught began. And, you know, that was the point where you had people hacking Trayvon Martin's Twitter account. That was the point where you had people posting fake pictures of him with gold teeth. That was really the point where you saw George Zimmerman raising in upwards of $1,000 a day for his defense. When the president spoke, it became racialized. The important thing to say here is I think he did the right thing. It's not his statements that I think where I find error. It is the reaction.
Right. The reaction to so many things is just unbelievable, actually. Just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about why he has found it necessary to do this. You write that the irony of Barack Obama is that he's become the most successful Black politician in American history by avoiding the radioactive racial issues of yesteryear by being clean, as Joe Biden labeled him. He has to do that. He certainly, you also say in another part of the article that he really could write, he could teach classes on black history because there are times when he cites some important moments in American history that might be not as well known. But as president, he avoids the racial issues of yesterday. Two questions. One, how aware is he of those racial issues? And two, why is it necessary for him to avoid those?
So as far as I can tell, I think he has a deep and genuine concern about race in the country. His first book is all, you know, it's very much concerned with race. His second book is also concerned with race to some extent. There's a chapter in Audacity of Hope about race. Obama, you know, when he taught, he was known to hand out readings from Richard Wright, from Ralph Ellison. He talked rather eloquently about the influence of the autobiography of Malcolm X in his life. He's a man who, you know, moved to Chicago, made a decision to root himself in the black community there, went to a politicized church. So I find it very hard to believe that, you know, he doesn't really know anything about race, or that, you know, he has suddenly, you know, lost his consciousness around the issue. I think it's there and intact. But I think he's made a decision that's, you know, you have to say is probably quite smart politically, and that is that he can't really in any sort of overt way touch race, because it just totally riles up his enemies, and it really scuttles, you know, actual substantive things that can be done for African Americans. A great example of that is healthcare, which I think, as we'll see over the next 10 to 15 years as this is rolled out, is a huge advance for African Americans, but in a subtle sort of way that doesn't require him to stand up on a soapbox and talk too much about what it'll do for black people.
And is it okay for most African Americans, and will we see that in the polls this go around, for the president to not really address issues of race?
I would put it like this. I would say it is not okay that we live in a country where the president, with all of his great experience around race, is not really free to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a firm believer in, you know, that old quote about in democracy you get the government you deserve. Obama is making a calculation based on the country he governs. And I don't think, you know, as I went through writing this article, there's ample evidence that, you know, it's not an incorrect calculation.
You spent some time, and this is such a dramatic story. I know she has a book out. We'll get her on the air down the road here with Shirley Sherrod recently, and go in some detail about this whole thing that happened because the administration is intimidated by the right wing specializing, as you say, in whipping up racial resentment. So she's compelled to resign on misleading clips that were altered. But it's an amazing story because of her family history, which I wasn't as aware of, and her response to the president. It's very telling, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, it probably, you know, is a moment where I was most disappointed because, again, you know, as somebody who, you know, I know is quite informed about the history of race in this country, I just thought his administration really should have known better. Here is a woman whose father was shot by a white man, who's actually a relative over there of theirs in a petty land dispute, a woman whose cousin was lynched and his body was displayed outside the courthouse in town, a woman who, you know, dedicated her young life to registering African Americans to vote, whose husband, Charles Sherrod, helped organize the Albany movement, which drew Martin Luther King to Albany, Georgia. And he's, you know, you and I are talking about small figures in the history of this country. And you know, specifically about Barack Obama, you were talking about figures who helped make him possible. And I don't just mean possible in the sense of a black president possible, but possible in a very deep sense of making it legal and okay for two people of two different quote-unquote races to actually produce a child. We forget that was illegal at some point in this country. And it was through the sacrifices of people like Shirley Sherrod that, you know, you don't see a mixed race African American child, you know, looked at as some sort of abomination, which is what it was by the larger country, you know, at the time when the civil rights movement was waging this war. So, you know, I felt that Obama specifically, personally, and the country at large really owed her a lot better.
And yet, what was really striking about this is when you first wrote to her requesting an interview, here is a woman who you would think would have a lot of animosity because she was really done wrong here, but she said that she didn't want to do anything to hurt the president.
That's right. That's right. That's
Isn't
right.
Isn't that something?
And yeah. I mean, because, you know, the fact of the matter is it's very similar to the calculus that, you know, civil rights movement, you know, made in the 60s, and that is that no one likes getting head over the head with a nightstick. No one likes, you know, having dogs sicked on them. You know, sometimes you don't get to obey your anger. It's just that simple. And African Americans have become very acquainted with that logic.
Do you know, was there a follow-up here? Did the president have any kind of quiet conversation with her and express deep apologies?
Yeah, according to her, he called her, but she was not particularly happy or pleased, you know, with even the call. You know, again, for me, the striking thing is this. When President Barack Obama made his comments about the police officer, James Crowley, who had arrested Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates on his porch and said the officer had acted stupidly, to make that right, the president had to have the police officer down to the White House for a beer in the infamous right. beer summit. Okay, you arrest somebody, arguably, as far as I'm concerned, definitely, you know, in a manner that should not have happened, and the end of that is that you end up having a beer with the president. Charlie Sherrod got a 7 to 8 minute phone call. There was no invitation to have coffee at the White House or anything like that. So, you know, he did call and he did try to deal with it. But I think what you see there is the difference in, you know, power.
Hmm. And she has a book coming out, doesn't she?
She does, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, a beautiful memoir.
But what does this mean? This is a striking thing that everybody pulls from your article. Barack Obama governs a nation enlightened enough to send an African-American to the White House, but not enlightened enough to accept a black man as its president. If we were enlightened enough to accept a black man as our president, what would that look like?
Well, we wouldn't have a good percentage of one of our major political parties arguing about whether the president was actually a natural-born citizen or not.
Right.
We would not have some of the most, you know, sought after and some of the most, you know, widely heard spokesmen for the conservative movement talking about how health care is reparations. We would not have them going on the radio claiming that in Obama's America, white kids get beat up by black kids. We wouldn't have a congressman like Steve King asserting that Obama, quote-unquote, always favors the black. We wouldn't have somebody like Tom Tancredo going before the Tea Party convention and claiming that the problem with 2008 was that we did not have literacy tests. You know, there's been a persistent strain of we wouldn't have Newt Gingrich standing on stage just denouncing the president as a quote-unquote food stamp president and then insisting that there's nothing racial about that designation at all. You know, there's a standard argument that Obama's facing the sort of opposition that Bill Clinton faced. And I think there's some truth to that, but I just can't imagine someone calling Bill Clinton a food stamp president. You know, I've never heard, you know, during when Bill Clinton was trying to pursue health care, it denounced as reparations. That's new, and it's particular to Obama.
Isn't it really, when you think about it, unbelievable that so many people have spent so much of their precious time on Earth arguing about whether or not the president is a natural-born citizen? It's just dumbfounding.
Yeah, and it's sad because it reflects this human tendency towards conspiracy theories. It's deeply depressing.
It is depressing. I was listening to some show over the last few weeks, and Reverend Al Sharpton was making a comment. Maybe it's one of his promos. I can't remember where I saw it. I see too much of this stuff. But he was making the comment that with all of that being thrown at him, the first African-American president has to, in a sense, be like a Jackie Robinson character, that he can't let any of this, all of those racial epithets that were thrown at Jackie Robinson, it was horrendous. And Obama's had some of the same, that he can't really respond to them, that he has to sort of rise above all of that. Some of that would make me mad as heck, but you wouldn't know it with him, would you?
Yeah, I mean, again, and this goes back to, you know, there's this weird synergy between him and between the president and Shirley Sherrod. You know, you don't really get to always act out of anger, you know. Mm-hmm. Jackie Robinson, you know, got cleated, and, you know, he had to keep going. People, you know, hurled all sorts of racial epithets at him, and he had to keep playing. This is the terrain as it is.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Please join the conversation and read the article, too. It's really a fascinating article, and it is in the current issue of The Atlantic. Our guest this hour is Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor for The Atlantic. Fear of a Black President is the name of the article. He's also the author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to your phone calls now, starting with Jeanette in La Crosse. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, what does a guest think that Romney meant during the Republican convention when he said, if there's a problem that comes up, we need an American to handle it? What do you think he meant by that? Was that a racist thing against Obama not being born here? What do you think that meant?
I think, again, it was the same as him making that that birther joke that he made just ahead of the convention. It is an appeal to a very old notion that the president is not one of us, you know. And this, you know, has long roots in this country. African Americans have long been looked upon skeptically as not being of this country, not worthy of citizenship, and this is just the latest manifestation of that.
Let's talk a little bit more about this having to speak in dulcet tones, et cetera. Part of Obama's genius, you write, is an ability to soothe race consciousness among whites. Any black person who's worked in the professional world is acquainted with this, but it's never been practiced at such a high level. You can't be angry. You have dulcet tones. And then you say, it reveals a country so infantile that it can countenance white acceptance of blacks only when they meet an Al Roker standard.
Yeah, again, you know, this it's you know, one of the things is we think about this, and it's a situation, and you know, often we underrate anger. Anger is part of being human. That's just true, you know. And unfortunately, it's a kind of a part of humanity that African Americans have long been acquainted with not particularly having access to. Before the civil rights movement, being angry and being black cost you your life. It still can. And with Obama, it can cost him his presidency, and I think he's really aware of that.
Mm-hmm. We go to Sharon in New Berlin. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, this gentleman is expressing something that I have thought for a long time, and often when things are said about the president, I think they would not say that to a white man, or they would not say that about a white man. I think this where he was born argument and organization is just an acceptable way, those people think, of expressing their prejudice. And that's what I think it is. I think that it's blatant prejudice, but because they can call it, well, there's something wrong with his birth certificate or something like that, that we are expressing our prejudice.
Ta-Nehisi.
I would totally agree. I mean, I really, really would agree. And a lot of, you know, when you'll talk to a lot of birthers, they'll say, no, it's not that. But again, there's, you know, when you look at the history, and you consider what citizenship is in this country. In 1790, when Congress defined citizenship, it made it very explicitly for white people. You see a line all the way, you know, you can go through the Lincoln-Douglas debate, where you see Douglas, Senator Douglas, outright stating that the government of the United States was not made to, you know, have access to any other person besides white people. After Abraham Lincoln is shot, you have a situation in which Andrew Johnson is asked about the franchise for African American men, and he says, "Well, any government that gives the franchise to African American to black men has quickly experienced a downfall all the way up into the 1950s at the dawn of the civil rights movement, where you actually have somebody like William F. Buckley, the intellectual progenitor of the modern-day conservative movement, arguing that black people actually don't want the right to vote. So there's a long history of attempting to deny African Americans citizenship rights among the possible aspirations for any natural-born American citizen. The presidency is the highest, and this is just a continuation of that same sort of disreputable tradition.
You include some of those quotes from people like Buckley, from people like Robert Byrd, who spent a lot of his life trying to amend what his ideas were in his during the Ku Klux Klan.
Right.
And all of that wasn't that long ago. When you look at this notion, you say, of blacks being unfit for political equality, it persisted way into the 20th century. I mean, people died for the right to vote, for heaven's sake, not very many years ago.
Yeah, and those people are still very much with us. John Lewis just spoke at the Democratic National Convention. So it's like you said, I mean, we want to believe it's ancient history. It kind of isn't, though.
Yeah. Thanks, Sharon, for your call. Dan in Whitewater, hi.
Yes, I don't want to sound prejudiced anyway, because I'm not, but I believe that in the first election for Barack Obama, I do believe that race did get him in the White House. I believe a lot of people wanted to see change. He was running on hope and change. And I think, you know, I'm a truck driver. I've talked to thousands of people across this nation, and I've talked to thousands of people who admittedly voted just because he was black, and they wanted to be part of history. And I think this time it's not about that. I think now it's completely about his past. The blacks out of the question. And on top of that, when it comes to his birth certificate, I really think if his father wouldn't have been Muslim and our 9/11 wouldn't have happened, I don't think his birth certificate wouldn't have happened. So I don't think that would have been brought up. I think if 9/11 would never have happened, his father was Muslim, it wouldn't have been an issue. But, you know, I really do believe that. I think race is a big part of what got him in the first time.
Well, his birth certificate should never have been an issue. But what about this? He got a momentum. He got votes that maybe he others wouldn't have had because he was African-American, and people were ready for this moment in history.
All people of any identity get votes because of who they are. George Bush got votes from Texans, almost certainly because he had lived in Texas. You know, Bill Clinton got votes certainly in the South in a way that, say, Jesse Jackson would not have gotten votes in the South. You know, people vote for people because of identity all the time. It's not so much what's different here is that to vote against Barack Obama because he's black. In other words, it's one thing to say, you know, we live in a country which is supposed to be diverse, and yet for all of our history, we have never had an African-American president. We've never had any president who wasn't a white male, and that says something about us. To feel uncomfortable about that is not the same as to feel as though I want that tradition to remain, that the presidency should be somebody white. So those two feelings are not equitable. I think the second thing to consider is the fact that we never think about everything it must have taken to be a black man in this country and to get to the very point at which you can run for president. Barack Obama is the product of a single mother, didn't have a father around, somehow got himself together and got himself into college, rose to be the editor of the Harvard Law Review, got into Columbia, very well educated, moved to Chicago, became a community organizer, rose to the ranks, ended up teaching at the University of Chicago. Only the third African-American senator since Reconstruction. This is a life of accomplishment. And all the while, he's running up against a deep and systemic racism that, you know, has characterized our country since his origin. So it's fine to begin the race, you know, at the moment that, you know, Barack Obama declares himself for the White House. But in fact, the race begins long, long before that. You know, the final thing I'll say is I think we can all agree that it's much easier to confess that I voted for Barack Obama because he was black and I wanted to make history, than it is to say I voted against him because he wasn't white. One brings a kind of disrepute that the other does not.
But part of the article, refresh my memory here, looks at those areas of the country, West Virginia and Colorado, that actually looks at the people who did not vote for him because he was black, probably.
Right. Well, the other part of that is we have actual evidence that people did vote against Barack Obama because he was black. In West Virginia, this is the primary. I mean, running against Hillary Clinton among Democrats, 20% of all voters in West Virginia openly said that race influenced their vote. Hillary Clinton walloped Barack Obama by like 40% in that state, in that same state in the Democratic primary this year. A guy who's in jail, an actual felon, won like 40% of the popular vote, beat Barack Obama in several precincts. So when people say race played a role here, you know, they aren't just, you know, sort of making it up. There's actual evidence against that. The final thing I'd add to that is, it's not like these people would have, who say, you know, they wanted to make history by voting for an African-American. It's not like they would have voted for Al Sharpton. The fact of the matter is, and since the early 80s, we've had African-Americans running for president. So if you wanted to make history, you could have made history in 84 and 88 with Jesse Jackson. Mm-hmm. You could have made history in 2004, Carol Moseley Braun, with Al Sharpton. But there are plenty of chances to make history if race were your sole deciding factor. For some reason, people chose Barack Obama.
Did you think that former President Clinton's comments were racist after Obama won the South Carolina primary and Clinton said Jesse Jackson won South Carolina in 84 and 88? He ran a good campaign and Obama ran a good campaign here.
I'm a little hesitant to call them racist, but I do think they are deeply troubling, and I don't know what other implication it could be. Yeah. Besides race, I don't know. I've never known how to take that statement except a statement, you know, of race. Plenty of other people, you know, also, you know, won in South Carolina. So I don't, you know, in 2004, I think it was John Kerry won in South Carolina. So why didn't he compare him to him? Hmm. You know, I didn't understand that at all.
Rich and Sullivan, hi.
Hi. Here's how we fight this, because, I mean, first, thanks of all for the program. It's great. But here's how we fight this, because there really is fear and of one another based on backgrounds, and there's sadness and anger associated with it. And I want to quote one of the great Western philosophers, Whoopi Goldberg, who said, "You sit with white folks who say my family goes back to County Cork, Ireland, or my family goes back to Sicily," and she writes in African American Lives, and you say, "I don't know. I think Florida." And here's my proposal. We fight this with humor, and if President Barack Obama is able to bring forth his great sense of humor in one of these debates, he really has to say something, and I mean this as a joke, something like, "Look, we all need UPCs, universal product codes. I'm going to propose that everybody gets their DNA sequenced, and when it comes to voter registration and voter IDs," which is also one of these things that's going around the country right now like a virus, "you have to have it tattooed on the inside of your arm, and unless you're of mixed race, you can't vote, because all of us are a mixture of something or another." Go to this website, mixedfolks.com, and just look at how we've labeled each other ridiculously over the years in various kinds of mixtures, octoroons and quadroons and stuff far worse from that. But thanks for the program. It's wonderful. But we need to fight this with humor, and he does too.
Thank you, Rich, for the call. Ta-Nehisi.
I'm all for more humor.
I'm all for more humor, too. But the darn thing is, sometimes the circumstances are so dire that there's nothing funny about it. It's just tragic, right?
That's true. Yeah, yes, that's true. That's true. But often you have that. You know, this goes back to the question you were asking about anger. You know, often you can't do anything but laugh.
Right. And the president has been pretty good with his humor about this.
He saw he made some birthday joke the other day about himself. So
right.
He's right. Trying.
For me, the Irish would get up in me, and I'd just say, "What?" I would lose it, you know. I guess you can't lose it. Mike, thanks, Rich, for your call. And Mike in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I was saying to your screen that I sometimes get frustrated with these kinds of dialogues that come up about President Barack Obama. You know, why he doesn't speak out more and. But, you know, on black people and black issues and that kind of thing. But you know, Barack Obama, to me, I mean, he's essentially more socially moderate Irish-American than he is African-American. And that should be expected. I mean, he's half Irish-American in terms of genealogy. He was raised primarily by his Irish-American grandparents, who were at most socially moderate. Culturally, professionally, he's an Ivy Leaguer to the highest degree. Columbia University, Harvard Law School, president of the Harvard Law Review. Why is he expected, or you know, to speak up like an angry black man when he's not angry? I mean, we don't expect any other ethnic Americans to show anger when they're not angry. And in fact, when they're not angry, in fact, we don't expect that of any other Ivy Leaguer, black Ivy Leaguer.
Mike, you don't think he would be angry when somebody tells him and says it over and over again, you weren't born in this country? You're not an American? Wouldn't that make him angry?
Well, he's a highly intelligent man. Why should he become angry over ignorance, over other people's ignorance?
Ta-Nehisi.
I think it's human to be angry. I think it's really, really human to be angry. I want to tackle this notion that he's an Irish American and not an African American. I went to Howard University, which is a historically black college in D.C. And you know, it's probably about 95% black. I knew plenty of people who were just like Barack Obama, who either had, I mean, I have friends, you know, from college who were totally raised by, you know, white parents, either through adoption or they were biracial or something like that. I think, like, you know, I don't want to make any sort of assumptions at all about your caller, but I think one of the things that happens is we think, you know, this notion of black is strictly relegated to inner cities or to the rural South or the South. We have an image in our mind of what it means to be black. W.E.B. Du Bois was from some town in western Massachusetts where there were almost no black people. Booker T. Washington was biracial. Frederick Douglass was biracial. Etta James was biracial. So this notion of biraciality, of not being sort of raised in whatever we think of as the typical African-American narrative, is in and of itself often quite African-American. If the same rules of identity were applied to who is and who isn't black, that you know, we're using here for Barack Obama to the people, you know, I went to school with, I think you'd have to disqualify a third of the college. A large number of those people were people who had been, including my wife, by the way, you know, people who had been raised in, you know, majority, if not predominantly, you know, 95-99% white environments and came to that university in much the same way Barack Obama came to the South Side of Chicago to try to find some part of themselves. Beyond that, I think, you know, here's the thing. Barack Obama calls himself an African American. That's how he terms himself. I think it's right to respect that definition. I think that's it at the end of the day. I think people get to define themselves. He defines himself as an African American. That's not something someone else puts on him. If he had an identity, you know, more akin to Tiger Woods, I would say respect that too. But that's his identity. I don't see any reason to question that.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. We go to Severa in Black River. Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd say regardless of the famous truths that our Constitution holds to be self-evident, Native, Black, Asian, and some Latinos, at its inception, they weren't even considered to be citizens, and they weren't considered non-persons. So I think even though all these people's official status has changed, 250 years doesn't seem to have been enough time for the perception or the actions of the ruling class to come to the fact that we're all in this together. I mean, the Constitution was drafted by and for white landowners, and I think we're still struggling with some aspects of this as it manifests itself in economics, law enforcement, legislation, and race relations. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely are still struggling. Do you know, the one thing I wanted to get across, though, having said that, is this is not a lack of progress. This is, in fact, how progress often happens. One step forward, two step forwards, one step backwards, one step forward, two step backwards. If you look at the period following the Civil War, what you saw is a large retrenchment in terms of labor patterns. African Americans effectively reduced once again to a kind of neo-slavery where they didn't have the ability to decide who they wanted to work for, when they wanted to work. Debt peonage in a sharecropping system. Having said that, it was also true that you could no longer take someone's 5-year-old kid, take them to the auction block, and sell them and in, you know, it basically ensure that they would never see their child again. That was progress. Progress is slow, you know, and sometimes it's halting, and sometimes it's back and forth. I don't, you know, even though I wrote this article, and I definitely stand by it. You know, one thing I really want to be clear is 2008 was definite progress. It was an actual change in this country.
Yes, it was. It was. It remains.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, I was struck by, and I know a lot of white commentators made a lot of this, maybe too much of this, but for the president to, at his acceptance speech, to say again, I am the president, I was struck by the last 4 years and what happened. Yeah. There was an incredible, as you well know, an incredible amount of emotion in this country, and there still is, that this man is president. When you look at where we've been and all the issues we've dealt with and all the people who have died and the struggles, and it is remarkable that he is president. And when he said it, you remembered all of that.
I'm president. I just want to add this. You know, we I think to some respect we have a hard time accepting that. I mean, and this is why, you know, I think you get one of the things that your early caller voice, that he only won because he was trying to make history. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we can't accept that this actually happened, that a politician, you know, who happened to be black, won. I mean, he actually won, and at this present moment appears to be winning again.
Yeah. But he hasn't. Let's take up some of these issues that he doesn't mm-hmm. discuss. Now, you talk about this whole way that he's decided not to take on racial issues has broad and deep consequences. It prevents him from addressing America's racial history or saying anything meaningful about present issues, mass incarceration or the drug war. There have been calls for him to take a softer line on state-level legalization of marijuana. He will not take up those issues in any forceful way because of this history, this racial history?
Yes, every one of those issues is racialized, and every one of those issues has been racialized for a long, long time in this country. And I think that's really where you see the substantive actual damage. You know, it's not so much that, you know, Barack Obama can't, say, hold a summit on race, which I don't think would change much of anything. It's that he can't address actual issues that have a kind of racial subtext. The biggest one, you know, is what, you know, in terms of what we're doing in terms of long-term incarceration in this country. There was a change in terms of the sentencing guidelines where we saw a lower ratio in terms of crack to cocaine. So we did have that, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. But we have a situation where we have more people in jail than, what, China? I mean, China has billions of people. You know, how do we have more people? It's just absolutely incredible. I was running the math a little while ago, and I think something on the order of 5% of all people in jail in the world are African-American men. That is horrendous, and it's an issue that he can't quite really directly address.
Yeah. And is this a related issue? His deportation, this is good to bring up, which he has deported many more undocumented immigrants. The children will stay here. He's moving perhaps toward the DREAM Act if he could get it passed. But he has sent a lot of people back. Is that related to this whole issue?
I think so. I do think so. I think a president whose identity was not as suspect would find it easier to move and would find much more maneuvering room.
Well, that's interesting. Let's welcome more phone calls. We'll do it in just a moment. Our guest, please read the article, Fear of a Black President. It's in the current issue of The Atlantic, and it's written by our guest, Ta-Nehisi Coates, senior editor for The Atlantic. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You have a lot of ways to communicate, and we'd like to hear from you. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A quick reminder, September 26th, the first selection in our Back to School Book Club, A Conversation of Common Sense by Thomas Paine, 10 o'clock, September 26th. Please read it. It's not very long, and we'll have a great discussion. Back to phone calls. Marilyn in Cleveland, Wisconsin is next. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I would like to come to the defense of President Obama for not addressing black issues. It's not a perfect parallel, but he is in somewhat the position of President Kennedy, there was a strong resistance in this country to having a Catholic president. That's thought to be why Al Smith got defeated. And when Kennedy was president, he had to be very careful not to appear that he was promoting Catholic ideals. And I would suspect that President Obama feels under somewhat that constraint.
I think that's exactly right. I think in fact, when I was researching this article, Al Smith was one of the figures that I looked at. I have no disagreement with that at all. I think had Hillary Clinton won, she would find herself. She found herself in the race. Not even in the presidency yet. Constrained by gender, there was this whole dialogue around how she had to look harder, and she had to be especially tough when it came to defense. All of that is a language that reflects some of our preconceptions regarding gender. So to some extent, I think anytime you're in an identity that's viewed with suspicion in terms of its ability to be commander-in-chief of this country, that's going to be the case. So I agree.
Thanks, Marilyn. Harry in Edison, hi.
Yes, I'd like the guests to remember that although there are many qualified Jews, we have not had a Jewish president yet. And I want to ask him, how would things be different if the president were Jewish or Mexican-American? Wouldn't the response be the same?
I doubt the response would be the same. But again, I think anytime you are somebody who is outside of what the quote-unquote mainstream of what we have had in terms of American presidents, you're going to have to address this issue. As the previous caller just said, you look at Al Smith, you look at John F. Kennedy, at that time they were outside of what the tradition held. So I don't know that it would be the same, but I do think there would be some issues. I think race in particular, and not just race, but African-American identity, because this country from its earliest origins had slavery, because slavery contributed so much to this country's economy, and because African-Americans are still around in some numbers, there's a particular and peculiar relationship that this country has with African-Americans. So I don't think it would necessarily be the same.
We went to war, for heaven's sake, over the issue of slavery.
That's right.
That's right.
5% of the country's population, 600,000 people died.
Right.
Our first president was killed over race. Our first president who was assassinated, Abraham Lincoln, by an avowed white supremacist. So this issue is at the core of us in a way that, other issues aren't necessarily in the same way.
And let's just ask, why do you think that is? It on some level, I just wonder, what in the world is wrong with people's heads on this issue? I don't quite understand it. You'd think that people would be embarrassed at this point.
Yeah. Again, I think it's because when we're talking about an issue like this, it's at the core of us. It goes back to, slavery helped, and I say this in no exaggerated way, but it helped make America possible. The Capitol was literally built by slaves, so I think it's just so, on a DNA level with us, so skeletal almost, that it's really, really hard to grapple with.
Mary in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Yes, I have a question for your guest. I noticed that he was kind of concerned about Clinton's remarks and that they might have been racial. And I have yet to hear you mention anything about Biden's remarks. Is it only Republicans that can do this, or is this something that both parties do?
His comments that he was clean, is that what you're referring to?
I'm having a hard time understanding you. I'm sorry.
What comments are you specifically referencing?
Well, when he was talking about Clinton maybe making a racial statement when Hillary lost to...
Right.
You know what I'm talking about now?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. What
and
Biden...
And with Biden, I'm talking about his y'all shackles.
Right.
Oh,
right.
The recent comment. Okay.
Right. Yes.
Okay, so a couple of things. No, it's not. Well, Clinton's a Democrat, so clearly it's not just Republicans. So let's just stipulate that. As I stipulated earlier, I was talking about the Democratic primary when we were talking about Hillary Clinton with Barack Obama. Specifically in terms of Biden's remarks, I cringed at them, and I wish he had not made them. No, it's not only, Democrats. I found those remarks a little patronizing. I just wish he hadn't done it.
Yeah. And I think, maybe I'm not hearing you correctly, but I think that we're talking about Democrats mostly who have made these kinds of remarks, Mary. Let's go to Jennifer in East Troy. Hi, Jennifer.
I'm just kind of saying what a previous caller had said, but I would compare President Obama coming into the presidency as, say, Jackie Robinson coming into Major League Baseball. He had to have the kind of personality and to just turn the other cheek when comments were made. He had to have that demeanor to be the person to break through. If you had the stereotypical angry black man, then, you know, that would have been a whole, he never would have gotten elected. So I'll just take the, that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. Do you want to respond, Ta-Nehisi?
Yeah, obviously that's true. I think the one thing we should remember about Jackie Robinson is he died at a very young age. He's about 51. And it is a great deal of stress to take that on. You know, I think it is true. I mean, you know, on one level, you know, you have to understand what the political calculus is of that sort of thing. But again, as an African American, who's, you know, seen people in the kind of corporate environments that reflect, though not on that high level, what the president is going through, where you can't fully express yourself in the way your colleagues do, that has effects.
And Hank Aaron followed Jackie Robinson and had lots of death threats as well, didn't he?
He did. And Hank Aaron was probably a little bit freer because of Jackie Robinson.
Right. Steve in Edgerton, hi.
Hello?
Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'd like to comment on two callers earlier. The first gentleman that said about him getting in because he was white, or being black, I'm sorry, and the other one about being Irish-American. And I'd like to kind of combine those two and state also what the other lady said about being Catholic, is that I think the reason some of the other black runners didn't get in, for instance, but is because I think they were already in the black movement. I think America wasn't quite ready for that yet. And then Barack Obama came along, and here he is, a black man, yes, raised by a white woman who he was college educated, very highly educated. He spoke white, essentially looked white, dressed white, and didn't run for those issues. And I think people were a little more able to kind of, and also he was running on this hope and change. And I think everybody wanted to see change. And if we go, okay, here's a black man, he's changed. He's different from what we normally see. And on top of that, he's doing hope and change. And maybe we'll get this hope and change because white ain't working, you know. So I think that was a large part of it. And I think, you know, if he would have been pushing the black issue, I don't think he would have got in. I think that was smart of him not to, if that was a large part of why he's running. But, you know, I think if he would have been pushing black issues, you know, America's still very racist. Got a lot of racism still, and I think it's going to take another couple hundred years to get rid of it.
All right. Ta-Nehisi.
Well, two things. I think your caller is right in the sense that Obama not being necessarily affiliated with a previous civil rights movement did help. I think that definitely helped. I would push back on the notion that he looks and talks white.
Yeah, I
don't
think
plenty,
so.
Plenty of African Americans who look and talk much like Obama does, and would really blanch at that description. But I do think that there is some point in there in terms of him not having a connection. One thing to be remembered about the notion that race helped Barack Obama. If Barack Obama didn't understand and his campaign didn't understand proportional delegation, none of this would have mattered. He would have lost to Hillary Clinton. That's just true. We know that. So, you know, we can say that race got him over, but the fact of the matter is, you know, those things are up in the air. We don't know. We do know if he had not understood proportional delegation. In other words, if they had not taken advantage of that, he would have lost. That's just true.
And should he be granted another 4 years? Does all of this become easier? Can he not worry as much and maybe speak out on incarceration rates and various issues? Or will it perpetually be difficult?
Well, I'm totally biased. I mean, I'm a flaming liberal, so I think he does deserve another 4 years. I think beyond that, though, I think he's done about as good as I would expect any African-American better, in fact, to perform. Given what he's faced. So, I'm an endorser.
Yeah. No, I mean in terms of whether or not he had to have this 4 years, so the next 4 years he would feel more comfortable because he didn't have to worry about re-election.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. I think that's possible. I think that's possible. I think not having re-election is, I think that is possible. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, it was a very, very interesting interview. I thank you, Ta-Nehisi, so much for being with us. What are you working on now, sir?
I'm supposed to be writing about football.
Oh, my gosh. I never expected that answer. You're kidding me. You go from
it's
this.
It's a long article about race, so I think I need to take a break for a minute and write about something else.
All right. Football it is. Thank you. Thank you so
right.
much. Thanks for
Thank
being
you.
With us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our guest, this hour, Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's senior editor for The Atlantic. The piece is, and I'm sure that Brett's put it on the, as he's good about that, put it on our Facebook page, Fear of a Black President. He is the senior editor for Atlantic, where he writes, it is there, he says. He writes about culture, politics, and social issues for theatlantic.com. And he's the author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. And thanks to you, everybody. It was an interesting hour we just had. We usually do, I think. Interesting morning. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead. Thanks for listening to this one on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.